creative, healing, and necessary.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to The Brave Files. I'm Heather Vickery, and today we have a really beautiful, special episode with you. I had the chance to talk to Sharon Tubbs. Now, Sharon is a really neat lady. She is a journalist. She is an anti-active or anti-racist worker, works in nonprofit, keynote speaker. She just is a really lovely, lovely person. But she also wrote a book following the story of her grandfather, who was in a life-altering accident. He was hit by a police officer in Alabama in the 1950s. And then subsequently, he filed a lawsuit to get damages and was kidnapped by the KKK. Listen, this book is really important. Her three words, creative, healing, and necessary, they hit the nail on the head. What I love so much about this conversation, though, is organically, through the process of telling this story, Sharon learned more about her own story, how to share, feel, experience what is true for her in her life. Essentially, how DNA and fear and trauma are passed down from one generation to the next and how that shows up and how acknowledging that can be part of our healing journey. It is really lovely to talk to her, that we talk about forgiveness, finding forgiveness for yourself in many ways, forgiveness for some people around you was really beautiful, and just the power and importance of speaking truth to history in order to heal and move forward differently and better. So let's head to it. Thank you so much. Here's Sharon Tubbs. You're listening to The Brave Files, where we share stories from people who've stepped out of fear and into bravery in every possible way. What we know for sure is that when we choose bravely on purpose, we choose bigger, we win bigger, and it's contagious. It's our hope that these stories connect with you and encourage you to embrace bravery in every possible way, day after day. Together, we can build a movement that enriches both our lives and our communities. The Brave Files is brought to you by Vickery & Co., a success and leadership coaching firm dedicated to helping you build a life and a business that you are absolutely in love with. Vickery & Co. offers group programs, membership communities, one-on-one coaching, VIP days, corporate trainings, workshops, keynote speaking, and so much more. Visit vickeryandco.com to get all the details. Hi, folks. Welcome back to The Brave Files. You know, I've long been curious about how trauma is passed down generation to generation through DNA. It's something we know conceptually happens, but we haven't been able to really say how or why. And today's guest, Sharon Tubbs, dives deep into this by writing about her family history, specifically her grandfather, Israel Page, in her new book, They Got Daddy. Sharon began her professional career as a newspaper reporter and editor. In a career that spanned 17 years, she's worked briefly for the Philadelphia Inquirer and then the Tampa Bay Times. And as a journalist, she covered various beats, including small town government, local crime, and national religious issues. Today, Sharon is a writer, an inspirational speaker, and the owner of Move Forward Communications. She's also the director of a nonprofit organization that empowers underserved residents in Fort Wayne, Indiana, to live healthier lives. So excited to connect with you, Sharon. Welcome to The Brave Files.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you so much. And I loved your three words. You're on this book tour. You have this new, well, I don't know when the book came out earlier this year.
Yeah. January 3rd.
January 3rd. So it's still pretty new. You're on a whole tour. And this show is just a little bit different than most of the others. So we talk about your personal journey through this versus just the book. And you were so cute. You had three words and they made perfect sense. And then you went, wait a minute. Those words describe the book, not my story.
Yes.
Which is totally normal. I really enjoyed the book. And when I wrote my review on Storygraph, I said, this is it's heartbreaking and really important and hard. But mm-hmm. I think we need to do, we must do hard things. We must not close our eyes and turn away from hard truths and history because, well, we're going to get into that. But
yeah.
It's just really necessary. And that's actually one of your words, wasn't it? Necessary.
Yes, necessary.
There you go. So let's just start, if we can. Can you share with folks why you decided to write this book in particular? You have a history. You are a writer. You are a journalist. You've got lots of content. Why this story?
So I wanted to write this because I feel like, and I have felt like for a few decades now, that makes me sound old. I'm not that old.
I know. But me too.
It's true. A couple of decades. Like, I was called to write it. So it wasn't that, you know, I've written some nonfiction and some fiction books. And in some respects, especially the fiction, those were kind of fun. This was fun, but in a different way, in the realm of fun that you're called to do. If that can be fun, if obligation can be fun, if achievement, if you can think of achievement as fun, that's the reason that it was fun, because I felt like I was checking off a box that was so important in my life to check off. And so I had to write this book. As you mentioned, it's about my grandfather, but it's also about me. And the book kind of meandered from its original, from my original intention for it. I had, you know, originally decided that I was going to write this book that delved into this tragic episode in my grandfather's life, in his story. And in doing so, I began to see how necessary it was to write this book, not just so that he could have a voice, but to write this book for me.
Yeah. Yes. And I love that. So I'm going to let you very briefly explain the story. Folks, you guys really should read this book. But you go back and forth. And I love books like that in general. Yeah. That's a writing style that I'm a big fan of, a historical chapter and then a modern current chapter. So do you want to give folks a quick overview of what They Got Daddy is about?
They Got Daddy came from a scene in my early childhood. I was in elementary. I was on the couch with my mother, and we were watching the local news. And on the news appeared this story about the Ku Klux Klan marching in some area of Indiana. And I looked at her and I said, what's that all about? In essence, I didn't understand. I'm African American. I went to an integrated school. I had white classmates, nice, lovely white teachers. And I didn't understand why these evil people that I had seen in, you know, some of the Black history documentaries, I didn't understand how or why they were still in existence with their white costumes on. And my mother said to me, yes, indeed, they are still around. And in fact, they got daddy, meaning her father, my grandfather. And that was the first that I had heard of something happening to my grandfather that was tragic. No one had ever talked about this. I knew who my grandfather was. He died when I was 7, but he had had dementia throughout my early life. And so I didn't really remember talking to him or doing anything with him. And so when she said this, those words stuck with me. And they kind of planted this seed in me of curiosity, of need to know what happened to him. What happened, I found later on through research and interviews with family members and people who were his contemporaries, in 1954, he got into a car accident with a white sheriff's deputy in Alabama. He was broadsided by the deputy, who was en route to take an inmate to an insane asylum. The accident left no injuries to speak of for the deputy and his passengers, but my grandfather lost his right arm. He lost the use of his right arm. And so that meant he could no longer drill wells, which was the family's primary source of income. So my grandfather was a well driller, a pastor, and a sharecropper. And so he could no longer bring in funds after losing his arm and livelihood. He subsequently sued the deputy for damages. And one day before the civil trial was about to begin in 1959, he was kidnapped by white men posing as preachers who came to the house. And so he was kidnapped and beaten and threatened that, you know, he better not ever tell anyone or go to trial, pursue the case, because it was inevitably a win for him and a loss for the white deputy. So that's basically what happened. And I found out those details because my mother and her siblings had forgotten many of the details. I found those out through research and interviews. And let me just say, they'd forgotten the details, but the pain and the trauma of the whole incident lingered.
Thank you so much for sharing that. So y'all have to read the book to know what happened. We're not going to give the ending away.
Okay.
The story. It's worth it. It's worth it. And I will tell you, like, I didn't until the last two chapters, I was like, what's going to happen? Mm. I really didn't know.
Yeah.
It was a fascinating journey to be on. What I found so engrossing was what you just said, which is, although they did not remember, they were still embodying that trauma. And in your introduction, which, you know, I really enjoyed the introduction. It felt, how do I want to say that? It really felt like I learned why this is so important, why this is so necessary in the introduction. And in the introduction, you write that lasting effects of trauma occur when a member of a group endures something horrendous that scars their group consciousness and changes their identity. And then you go on to say that this has happened to several groups of people, including Jewish people, Japanese Americans, and of course, Black Americans. So this is such an important thing for folks to understand. And some people want to say, well, this was a long time ago, let's get over it. Well, we know that those folks, we know they're racist. We know that. We know we all are. But some of us are in different parts of the trajectory. We know that, right? Because if you want to just hide from history and pretend that it didn't happen, well, we want to know why. Why would you hide behind a white robe and a hood as well, right? So from the work that you've done, can you share why you personally think that, you know, it was a long time ago and no, we're not going to get over it. We have to talk about it in order to heal from it.
So I can best answer that now after having written the book, because, you know, before having written the book, I would have said something that I had, you know, read or thought tangentially about. But now I really am a believer that unless we tackle our history, we're not fully able to heal. And I say that because as I was writing this book, my grandfather's story, you mentioned that the story, you know, goes back and forth between his story and some of the things in modern times. Well, some of the things in modern times I talk about are my own journey and my family, my immediate family's journey and experiences with racism. As I was writing my grandfather's story, these memories of my own in childhood, as a young adult, surfaced. And I would be sitting there and wondering, why am I thinking about that? Oh, this happened. This happened. Oh, and that happened. And I felt some kind of way, as they say, about this happening. And didn't really deal with it having happened. And so, you know, for instance, I would be writing about my grandfather and, you know, my grandparents and their upbringing and how they raised my mother and siblings and then going through this tragedy, and started thinking about racism and how, you know, I felt when someone in a retail store literally almost chased my sister and I out of the store,
suspecting that we were
stealing something. Now, you've heard that, and I've heard that many times, but for some reason, while I'm writing his story, that comes up, and I start thinking, wait a minute, I never really processed that. I until now, because it was so commonplace in hearing about it, I never processed my own experience with it now as an adult, because then I was scared. I never went back to that store. Mm-hmm. There was fear. But now I have the opportunity as an adult to think about it in hindsight and to process those feelings and how that fit into the context of me as a Black woman in America and how that affects my look, my outlook on things that are happening to me and my relationships with white Americans. And so it's the processing of those things that we kind of forego and don't get into. We just let these things happen, or I let those things happen until I started thinking about history. Until I started thinking about my grandfather's story. And then these things began to come up, and I would have to process them and think about them and heal from them. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it was so necessary. And that is how I began to really unearth the traumatic effect of historical events on our lives today and how those things are passed down through generations.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. How has your going through this experience affected your family at all? Are they finding some healing journey through this with you as well? Or does everyone have to do it on their own, I guess, is my question.
Everyone does have to do it on their own. I have to say that it's not like everyone in my family has read this book or is really eager and, well, you know, hey, let me read this. Yeah.
They want to hide. Yeah.
A couple of them didn't want to be interviewed for it.
Wow.
And it wasn't necessarily a matter of hiding, but they are very close to it. Like they knew my grandfather more closely than I did. Like I said, I'm a little removed because I didn't know him as a man. And in the book, I talk about how I finally got to know him after his death through the interviews and through the research that I did. But them having grown up at him being their father, you know, it's hard to revisit this traumatic episode. And so, you know, my mom looks at the pictures. There's some family pictures in there of her and my dad doing the bump. And
they were so cute.
And so she's able to look at the pictures in the family reunion photo and enjoy those. But going back to the details of this, it sparks a certain personal anger. You know, people who have read it talk about how I'm angry, but can you think about it at, you know, how you would feel if it was your father going through this. Yeah. And so that trauma continues to have an effect in their minds and in their bodies that, you know, 60 years later, you can still cry about this.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's so powerful to. And also, it just has to be okay to, for you to be going down this healing journey. And for you to be passing that on generationally. And everyone has to do it at their own pace. Where I think it gets interesting is folks who are trying to stop other people from going down their healing journey.
Right.
I'm all for do what you want to do as long as it doesn't take away somebody else's freedom or somebody else's right. Right. And so you can be down this healing journey and everybody else is going to go at their own pace. Did anything really surprise you in your research phase, in the writing phase of this book?
The twists and turns that took place historically surprised me because I didn't know all of these things that were taking place. I didn't know anything about the deputy involved. I didn't know that, you know, some people did receive, or at least one person did receive damages from the accident, one of his passengers. So those types of things were surprising. I didn't know the complexity of racism, in that there were even my grandfather's attorney, who was a white gentleman, an attorney in Marion, Alabama, you know, was he, you know, for my grandfather in terms, he was for him.
There's some
in terms,
debate. Yeah.
There's, you know, in terms of getting compensation, and the attorney would have gotten a share of that, a percentage of that as well. But in terms of him getting justice, you know, there's some political ambiguity there that I would say that existed in that time. So those things surprised me. And one of the biggest surprises, the personal surprises that I experienced, and, you know, this is an example of what you were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, the cultural trauma, was that I forgave myself writing this book. So there's an instance in the book that I talk about, and I was a young reporter in St. Petersburg, Florida, working for, it was then the St. Pete Times and now the Tampa Bay Times. And I was assigned to cover the Ku Klux Klan one Saturday morning. And I was automatically given the assignment because I was the reporter on duty on Saturdays. You know, newspapers are very thin in terms of personnel. And so I was the one on duty in that county. And so the Klan was marching and in downtown St. Pete, and I was supposed to go and cover it. And I went to cover this, and I'm standing across the street, and there's this line of men in the white chic costumes with the hoods. And I am totally afraid. Now, this is the 1990s, and I'm afraid. And I was ashamed of being afraid. And so I was across the street, and I was, you know, as a reporter, I'm trying to think of anything that I can do to at least delay this confrontation that I knew was inevitable. And that was me going to the Klan. You know, you want to cover both sides of any story. And I had, you know, tried to interview people as they were walking in downtown St. Pete and, you know, talk to them about this. And most people didn't want to be on record in any way. They were just like, let me get out of here, you know, because this is craziness. This is cray cray. And so they were going to their cars. I think I got a couple of comments and things. And then I knew I had to interview the Klan people. And so I walked across the street and I'm looking at the leader of this group. And he was an older gentleman. And I remember by his gray eyebrows, because they had the hoods on, the kind that you could, that were the faces exposed. I don't know.
The whole thing just makes me feel legitimately ill. I hate that you had that experience. This. I'm so sorry.
Well, no, it's not your fault. You weren't there.
Oh, I know. So. I know. I'm not taking responsibility. Right. I just wish you didn't have to do that.
Yes. And so I went and, you know, faced this gentleman. I had decided I'm not going to call him sir. I'm not going to give him that dignity. I will not say sir, this, that. But when I got in front of him and I've got my little notebook out and I've got my pen and I asked him what his name was, the fear is evident that there's something in me that's like, shaky. And my voice is shaky. And he obviously sees this and recognizes this, and he smirks.
Ugh.
And so I'm like, oh my gosh, totally humiliated. And so I ask a couple more questions and I walk away, you know, but just feeling like defeated and humiliated.
Yeah.
And I never told anyone that story. I went back to the office and I, you know, told the editor. Nothing really happened. There were no outbursts. These guys were just, you know, walking down the street with these signs and people were trying to get out of the way. There was nothing really going on there. And they were doing this in the aftermath of a cop killing. A police officer had shot and killed Tyron Lewis in St. Petersburg. And so there was some race issue. There were race issues going on. So anyway, I didn't tell my editor. I never told a soul about this encounter. I mean, the people knew that I had gone to do this, but they didn't know about this interaction between myself and this Klan guy. And we didn't write a story about it because nothing really happened. But when I was writing the story about my grandfather, this comes up again. And I'm wondering, wait a minute. The Klan, we believe it was the Klan. It was definitely white supremacists who kidnapped my grandfather. There was a heavy Klan presence in the town where he lived. In fact, they would go and ride on horses and tell black people when to get off the street. There was a street called the N-word. And there were a lot of black clubs along the street. Wow. And so at a certain time of night, the Klan would ride on their horses and shoo everybody home. And so there was a heavy Klan presence in the Browns Uniontown community. So I'm thinking back as I'm writing the story. Okay, so we have this Klan white supremacist presence there. This is who kidnapped him. The Klan, they were the ones that I saw in the news when I was asking my mother about this, and she told me they got daddy. And then I go and I'm interviewing the Klan. And so I began to wonder if my reaction to this story had to do with the trauma that had been experienced throughout my family line. Because, you know, some black people, they might have covered this and been like, oh, you know, F these people or whatever the case may be. I'm going to write this story.
Who knows? They might have. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and my editor was a black man, the one who assigned me to the story. He was like, yeah, go down there, cover this. And it was, you know, to him, it wasn't a fear. There wasn't a fear factor. So he wouldn't have connected that, because I talked to him years later. There wasn't a fear factor. It was in the broad daylight. We were in downtown St. Petersburg. You know, nothing was going to happen to me. So where was the fear? So that I began to process that in light of what had gone on before.
Yeah.
And so in writing this, I was able to forgive myself and to begin to talk about that incident and to not hold it in as shame, which is what I had done. I had been holding it in as this shameful experience. And so I began to release it in writing this. And that was the surprise, that I could say, Sharon, it was okay that you did that. It was totally fine that you reacted that way. And now let's give yourself grace and move on.
I love that. I literally had down one of my questions I wanted to ask you was, what is your relationship with forgiveness? And that's so beautiful to me. What a terrifying story. It makes sense to me why you would have been scared, mm-hmm. even if you didn't have the family trauma mm-hmm. that you have.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense to me. But that goes back to that almost anthropological DNA transfer of fear, right? When this,
yeah,
because, you know, without any knowing, without any knowledge or awareness, your grandfather was kidnapped,
right,
by the same people that you were about to go face to face with. And
right.
So if you had pushed that, if you could, would they come find you? Like, you wouldn't even know that. You wouldn't even think about that. You wouldn't be aware of it. But of course, it makes sense that your body remembers, the mm-hmm. body knows, it's passed down. That's so, wow. But I love that you were able to forgive yourself for that reaction, which was totally normal.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Klan members that would go down and tell people when to go back, and that makes me think of the sundown towns, which is something that mm-hmm. we've heard of a lot. You specifically mention Martinsville, Indiana, in your book.
Yes.
And I bring this up because my grandmother lived next door in Mooresville, Indiana. Mm. Now, I grew up, we're very close in age. I grew up in the 80s. We were raised to be colorblind, which basically was just an excuse to not talk about it. Because if you don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. And then, you know, fine, pretend. Except the one place we knew that was racist as hell was Martinsville and Mooresville. Right. Like that was, we knew, we were like, I remember in the early 80s, I wore my Michael Jackson button to my grandmother's house. And I walked in and she said, you better take that off before you walk around town. And I was like, what? Like, what are you talking about? And that has, the story sticks with me all the time because they didn't care. They owned their racism. But you tell this story, you went to IU, your brother went to IU.
Yeah.
You don't stop in Martinsville at night because it doesn't feel safe. And I'm just wondering if, since you've written the book, have you been back there? Has your experience been different? Or are you able to just be really comfortable with, I don't need to fucking go there. Like, I don't need to go there. No, I don't know. I'm curious.
To go to IU?
Or to Martinsville. Like you have to go through Martinsville to get to IU from Fort Wayne, which you don't live there anymore. But, you know.
Well, I do live in Fort Wayne now.
Oh, you're back in Fort Wayne. Okay.
I'm back in Fort Wayne. And so there was, I was in the process of writing the book or researching my grandfather's story and writing some parts of it in 2019. And I had gone to IU, as you say, and I was on the what was called the union board. It was a student group that we oversaw student programming for the university. And so we were having our 25th anniversary of my board when I was on the board. And several people on the board were saying, Sharon, you got to come back. You got to come back. I hadn't been back to Indiana University. So I said, yeah, I'm going to come. I'm going to go back to IU. And so I was driving from Fort Wayne, reminiscent of many, many years ago when I was a student. And I'm driving from Fort Wayne down to IU. I got a late start. And so by the time I'm almost there, I'm hungry and it's getting dark. It's dark outside. And so I'm like, I got to stop and get me a sandwich. And as soon as I said that, here comes a big sign. Welcome to Martinsville.
Wow.
I hadn't thought about Martinsville. You know, I've been as a reporter in my previous career as a reporter, I've been many places. You know, I've lived in Jersey, Philly area. I've, you know, lived in Florida. I've traveled and, you know, on, you know, assignment, and I've asked people, did you do it? Right to their, you know, that was like, did you do this? I've traveled
to the bad guy.
Yes.
Like, you're not afraid. What you're trying to say is, I am not a scared
exactly.
person.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I'm traveling here and I see this Martinsville sign and I start trembling.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? What is happening? And I remember that I'm not supposed to be driving through Martinsville when it's dark outside. And I'm a big grown woman, Heather. Big and grown.
I understand.
You see what
I'm
saying?
I do. What is,
and I'm like, Sharon, this is stupid. That was decades ago. Go, stop. Get something to eat. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't stop. I didn't want to. I was like, I will be hungry. And I went to Indiana University. I did not stop. I did not pass go. And I went to Indiana University and I waited and got something to eat in the on the safety of the, you know,
the campus.
Progressive campus. Wow. So those stories linger. Even if nothing happened, just the stories and the way that a group of people has to rearrange their life based on the fear of what might happen is traumatic. Yeah. And my brother did have an incident that happened to him when he was in high school and his track team went through Martinsville, stopped at the McDonald's there. And some guy stopped them and said, you know, if you don't get your, you know, black behinds, didn't use such nice language in the bus, on that bus, I'm going to run you over. Oh, and he said, I know the sheriff and he's not going to do anything about it. And so again, that was just this guy saying that, but that then just perpetuates this idea and this fear within us that sheriff's not going to do anything about it.
And whether or not that was
come
true.
To find out, the sheriff's whether or not it was true, it's just this fear that's perpetuating because remember, it was a sheriff's deputy that did this to my grandfather and refused to pay the damages. So all of these things are just filtering down and they were coming up as I'm writing this book and I'm able to process what is actually happening. And I think, okay, wow, this is some traumatic stuff that you're experiencing, Sharon. And you're the, you know, director of this nonprofit that talks to people about dealing with trauma and mental health and all of these things and racism and the effects of it and the effects on health. And here you are experiencing some of these same things and you didn't even know it.
I mean, that's so profound, right? Is that you aren't that different from those people. I mean, you haven't had the same traumas that they've had, but we all mm-hmm. do experience fear and experience trauma on very different levels.
Right.
Did that change the way you did your work to have that realization and say, I don't know more than you. I'm not like less afraid than you. It's just different. It's about different things, the things that scare mm-hmm. you or the things that scare me. Did that change how you do your job at all?
It made me more aware.
Yeah.
Of how, you know, I would say, but for the grace of God, go I. That, you know, we're all entangled mm-hmm. to me on this earth. You know, despite our, you know, skin color or where we're from, you, Heather, have likely experienced some traumatic events. Dare I say some things that have been passed down from in your family.
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
So we're experiencing these things in our lives. And if we don't stop and begin to process those things and think about them and really give ourselves the space to feel it, and then overcome it and decide to overcome them, that's where we get trapped in cycles. And that's where we don't give ourselves the power, the space that we need to overcome. And that power, I believe, is within us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I do believe it's within us. I love that. And so you now are a professional speaker. And I'm curious, you share one story in the book, and I'm wondering how often this happens. We talked about the colorblind concept. Just makes me mm-hmm. angry just to even think about having been raised that way. But mm-hmm. it is what it is.
Well, colorblindness used to be the thing. That
was the thing. They thought it was the right thing.
Right. Yeah. That was the thing.
We didn't celebrate differences. We pretended everybody was the same. And if you pretend right. everybody is the same, then nobody can be better than anybody else, except it doesn't work like that.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love celebrating people's differences. In fact, this is not where I was going to go with this, but I saw something on Instagram today that I was really fascinated. I'd be really curious to hear your opinion on this. It said, I love the people who unknowingly go through the world and just make everything better. And it was all pretty and it had all these flowers and people were like, I love this. And I thought, gosh, if they don't know that they make things better, what do they do when they're alone? Are they hard on themselves? Do they not mm-hmm. feel like, I would love to see that person know that they are powerful and worthy and that they change other people's lives, that they touch other people. And so everyone was all loving on it. And I'm like, I don't think so. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, not having seen it and haven't, you know, had a chance to think about it, my first thought is that true change is intentional.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it could be that I, you know, I walk along the sidewalk and I drop a $10 bill and I'm happily skipping along and somebody picks up that $10 and it changes them because they are able to go and buy a meal or something that day.
Sure. Yeah.
That's possible.
Absolutely.
That's very possible. Yeah. But in terms of growth within ourselves, I didn't gain anything from the not knowing because I just dropped it. You see
That's
what I'm
right.
saying? But if I gave it intentionally, if I gave it to someone that was in need or that I really felt I was called to give it, now I'm sacrificing something of myself and it's an intentional piece of growth. Maybe I should say true growth is intentional.
True growth is intentional. Yeah, I love that. I agree. And it's empowering. Even if we didn't know it, even if your kind word or your smile mm-hmm. made a difference, if that person says, you know, I needed that from you today, mm-hmm. then you go, oh, I'm going to be more aware of making sure
right.
that I'm thoughtful and kind, right? So we got derailed, but I thought, I think Sharon might resonate with this.
You put me on the spot, Heather.
I'm sorry. I know. We do that sometimes. You're a journalist. We do that sometimes.
Right.
No, where I was going with as a public speaker and an mm-hmm. advocate and all of this, how often are you faced with people whose, you know, they're quote unquote allies. They say all the right things. But they don't really want to talk about it. I think about in the book, you talk about the son of the attorney, and he was like, I don't want to talk about it because he feels guilty. There's shame attached to the fact that his dad was actually a secret asshole, right? Like, you know, but I'm just wondering, when you're out speaking and you're telling the story, which is so important, and we cannot heal and we cannot face this trauma if we don't talk about truths, do you get pushback? And how do you deal with that pushback?
It's interesting because I think most of the pushback that I experience now, sometimes it's silent pushback, but I can feel it. I know you're pushing back. Don't try to play it off. You're pushing back. But in the nonprofit arena. So right now, I know, right? Isn't that surprising? That's shocking.
Wow.
So what I have found is that a number of people, I won't say a lot, but there are some in the nonprofit realm, okay, who are comfortable in the nonprofit realm because just being in the nonprofit realm makes them look good and good-hearted. Mm-hmm. I'm the leader of this organization, and we help people who are underserved or underprivileged. We help people of color do this and that. However, those people, sometimes I have found shockingly,
should get air quotes, you guys.
In their own personal lives, are not for the underprivileged or the underserved, if it means that they have to give up some of their own privilege.
There you go.
So I'm fine, you know, helping people as long as I'm getting paid, maybe not a whole lot, but I'm getting paid.
And acknowledged. This is my job. A little pat on the back. Yeah.
I'm getting acknowledged. I may be getting some awards in the community. But when it comes down to any kind of a sacrifice, like, you know, Obamacare, for instance, if my premium has to be higher for everybody else, for the people that I'm fighting to have insurance, if my premium has to go up in order for them to have insurance, I got a problem with that. Now, let me say that with a caveat. I agree that there need to be some reforms and some change in that system. But if you're saying, well, I would just get rid of the whole thing because it's a bunch of mess and I can't pay these premiums and my friends are paying premiums that are higher, and let's just go back to the old way. But wait a minute, aren't you a nonprofit director? Aren't you working for these same people?
Yeah.
If they had health care, then they might not have to have all of these other services.
Yep.
Right. What about that piece? Okay. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a lot of that. And I've been shocked to see in the nonprofit realm that everybody in the nonprofit realm is not for the underserved, especially if they have to give up something, or if they have to acknowledge that they grew up in a racist home, or that affected them. That's where I've seen some of the pushback, in that, you know, you're telling a story and it's like, oh, well, I experienced that too. Oh, well, my family did this. We're not Black, but this happened. And there's this minimization of somebody else's experience based on your experience, which is a valid experience. It's just not the same.
It's not the same.
And so, right. Yeah.
That damn argument infuriates me. Like, nobody is trying to tell anybody that you haven't struggled.
Right.
All we're saying is you do not struggle before you start because of the color of your skin if you're white. That's
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
That's what it is. Yeah. And we have to acknowledge that. We have to admit that. Because, yes, of course, you're right that there's trauma in my family and that things have been passed down. In fact, I'm actively working through that. What does that look like? How can I heal so that my children and their children can heal? But it is different than yours.
Right.
Period.
Exactly.
It's just that simple.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, this interesting. Feels like an interesting segue, but also a good one, because I'm curious, when you face that, well, this is a big question, Sharon. What do you do? Do you just go, well, you're going to think what you're going to think and walk away? Or do you go, no, do you hear yourself? Like, what do you do?
I remember engaging. I didn't start the conversation. I'll say. And someone else started this other person started the conversation, I guess thinking that, you know, she was going to make her point about, you know, all of these political issues, and that, you know, we basically are getting equal opportunity now, even though the foundation.
Does anybody really think that? Those people make me mad. No, I'm sure you're right, but it just makes me mad. Sorry.
I think so. And so there was some significant exchange between us, but there came a point when I saw that, okay, I've said what I said, and either she's going to think about this or not. And she wasn't. It just continued to be a back and forth. And at that point, I let it go. Now, there's an example also in the book a few years back. The first time I actually spoke about my grandfather's story, and that was at a big church, a mega church. And I was giving this message, and it was, I thought that I could spin it. And I shouldn't say spin it, but, you know, because I wanted it to be authentic. I thought that I was using my grandfather's story in front of this mixed crowd, predominantly white, but mixed, that to talk about overcoming difficulties in life. So my grandfather, he went through all of these things, but in the end, he began to lean on his faith and talked about how he was overcoming the things that had happened to him by faith, right? And like I said, we all have those instances in our lives, those experiences that we must overcome. We have to choose to overcome those and move forward. And so that's what my grandfather did. And at the end of that, I felt pretty good about, you know, what I had said. And I was getting a few amens, you know, and went home. And then later on that evening, I got a call from one of the pastors at the church, not the lead pastor, but one of the pastors. And he very nicely told me that I shouldn't have talked about that in that way. It made him feel guilty. And he wasn't the only one, you know, these things about racism, it made him feel guilty. There are a lot of white people there, and none of them had anything to do with racism back then. And so it wasn't a great feeling, you know, for him to process that.
And it wasn't supposed to be a great feeling, Pastor. Sorry.
But I was trying to make it an uplifting thing, to say, I know you've gone through all these things in your life, but you can get back up again. So basically he was saying, hey, didn't work. We feel bad still about that racism part. Okay. So that in that instance, I did let it go. And I regret that, because I never, I didn't speak about that anymore. I didn't, I made it go away because I liked this pastor. We had a relationship in terms of having talked in the past about different things. And so I believe that's why he thought that he could, you know, come to me with this feeling that he had, or maybe he was appointed by some others. I'm not sure. But I let it go. And, you know, in retrospect, I should have initiated some type of a broader discussion on this topic. And I didn't. I let it go. And I did something that a lot of Black people do, or a lot of people of color do. I wanted to protect him. Because I knew that if I started telling other Black people in the church, some feathers would be ruffled and it wouldn't be a good scene. And this church had been trying to overcome some of the racial issues there. So I kind of let it go and didn't say anything. But now I wish, hey, this was an opportunity for us to dialogue and to make some things better.
Absolutely. It's perspective is everything, right? And I imagine if you were to find yourself in that situation again, you would respond differently.
Yes, most definitely.
And to me, that's worth celebrating, Like we learn. Yeah. We do the best we can with what we know at each and every moment of our lives. And I deeply mm-hmm. believe that truly about almost everyone. Is mm-hmm. there an exception to every rule? Yes. But I think most people are doing the very best they can.
Yeah.
And then when we know better, to quote Maya Angelou, we do better, or at least yes. we should do better.
Yeah.
And that's worth celebrating. And so one of the questions that I ask every week on this show is, how do you celebrate? And that can be anything. It can be, you know, facing truth or overcoming trauma or getting your book published or mm-hmm. a new job or helping somebody or anything. How do you like to celebrate?
Well, I'm not a consistent celebrator, which is unfortunate, but I celebrated in the month of February. I had a big, big birthday. Okay. Oh, it was a huge
happy
one.
Birthday.
Thank you. and I took a trip. I celebrated all month. And so I took a trip to the Dominican Republic. I went to Atlanta on another weekend. I went to St. Louis. I just felt good about seeing old friends, some of them I hadn't seen in years, decades, and just basking on the beach and reading. I like to read. Going and just relaxing. That's my celebratory spirit. That's what I like to do. So relaxing, reading, finding time to do what I want to do.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, I'm an avid reader as well, and I'm an avid mm-hmm. relaxer. Like, mm-hmm. I'm just going to not. That's it. So I think it's a beautiful way to celebrate. I hope that you are able to consciously choose, just like you said, intentional growth is a choice. I think that celebration is a choice also.
It is.
And we can find so many reasons to celebrate. And I always say that once momentum starts, the more we find to celebrate, the more we have to celebrate, which is always really fun. And then I get to, and maybe you can, I'll be curious to hear what you share here. What is your favorite charitable organization to support?
Well, I have to say mine. And I say it's not mine. It's not the organization that I didn't found this organization. I'm the director of it. And so money doesn't come to me. But Health Visions Midwest is an organization where we are just kind of like boots on the ground. And we talk to people directly. We engage with people of color who don't even speak English. And we have just found remarkable things happening. You know, we've been able to stop a hospital from, you know, telling a woman who was in need of care that she had to go because she wasn't speaking English. Well, that's not legal.
No.
You can't do that. Mm-hmm. And we were able to give the assistance that she needed. And she stayed in the hospital another week, which is what needed to happen. I mean, so we've done that. We've been able to help people to improve their physical health through education, you know, educating them about diabetes and high blood pressure. And we don't have to have these things, people. And it's not all about nutrition. A lot of it is systemic.
Absolutely.
It's the environment where people live. Do they have the opportunity to get fresh fruits and vegetables in their community? Well, no, because there's not a grocery store here. Yeah. So all of those things, Health Visions Midwest is my favorite charitable organization because I see the work that we're doing and how necessary it is.
I love that. Well, thank you for sharing them with us. They will be our charity of the week. So we'll give them a little love. And folks listening, you know the drill. Go check them out. Find out what they're doing and give what you can, whether it's time, money, social media likes, share, tell somebody else about it, whatever is something you can do, then let's do that. Sharon, I love this. I love getting to talk to you. Can you tell folks how to find you, connect with you, all that good stuff?
Sure. I have a website. It's sharontubbs.com, sharontubbs.com. And you can connect with me there. You can find all my stuff and all that good stuff is right there.
I love that. And we'll put a link to the book in the show notes. You guys can go and grab that as well. Sharon, will you share your three words with us one last time?
Creative, healing, and necessary.
Yeah. They're beautiful words, and you are beautiful.
Thank you.
And I'm so grateful that you are out here doing the work that you're doing, healing yourself and sharing with other people how they can hopefully follow that path. Sharon, thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather. It's been a pleasure.
Wow. I just thought that was magical. It's so important. And when we finished recording, Sharon said, this isn't as uplifting and happy as some of your episodes, because the last couple of episodes, we had some fun, lighthearted stuff. And I reminded her that the Brave Files tells real stories. And sometimes those real stories are fun and uplifting. And sometimes they're really hard. And hearing truth and history like this can be very hard. It can be very uncomfortable. And just because we didn't cause this, we white people did not cause this harm. And certainly there are plenty of folks who are still causing harm. I guess I'm guessing if you listen to this show, you're not one of those people. At least you try not to be one of those people. We make mistakes sometimes. It doesn't mean that we don't have responsibility for shifting and being supportive moving forward. So it was really beautiful. I am so grateful to Sharon for coming and telling her truth. I can imagine that it's difficult to go over it again, over and over, and to reshare it and to relive it. And I really honor and admire that she finds healing and new opportunities in so doing. It was really lovely. I would love to hear what you think. You can give your feedback by emailing heather@vickeryandco.com, or you can find us on Instagram and you want to DM the Brave Files podcast. Let us know what you're thinking, what you're feeling, all of that stuff. I personally will respond to you because that's just the way I roll. And if you love the content that I'm putting out here on the Brave Files or our sister podcast, Was It Chance, or my weekly live show, Brave in Action, which I hope you're catching. We're live every Tuesday, 1:30 p.m. Central on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can get all of those details if you go to vickeryandco.com/social. You can sign up for my newsletter. You can find the live show, all that fun stuff. If you like the content that I'm giving out and you want to say thanks or maybe buy me a coffee for the week, I have made that easy to do. You guys asked and I responded. If you go to vickeryandco.com/say thanks, you can contribute whatever you feel the time, the effort, the learning, the inspiration, the bravery is worth, and I will be forever grateful. And not only that, I will be grateful. I will say thanks for your thanks. I will either mention you in the podcast, in the newsletter, or the live show. So again, that's vickeryandco.com/say thanks if you would like to contribute. Give a little tip, buy a coffee, and I look forward to being with you all again really soon. Until then, this is Heather Vickery reminding you today and every single day to go out and choose bravely. Bye now. You've been listening to The Brave Files, stories of people living courageously. Visit us at thebravefilespodcast.com to learn more about the show, find our show notes, and access full episode transcripts. And we'd love to know what you think of the show. We invite you to connect with us via Instagram and send a DM. You'll find us at The Brave Files Podcast on Instagram. Our music was created and produced in a custom collaboration with Matt Lewis from ML Creative Consulting, a boutique firm dedicated to helping clients identify their unique sound and amplify their brand with custom-delivered soundtracks. Special thanks to everyone on Team Brave, from our audio engineer to our producers, associate producers, copy editors, writers, and support team. The show wouldn't exist without them, and we are eternally grateful. I'm your host and executive producer, Heather Vickery. Thanks for tuning in.